Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Defense Information Systems Agency is hard at work on the next generation of mobile secure computing for the Defense Department. And it's up to some heavy contracting activity. Federal News Radio Scott Massioni attended the annual DISA conference and joins me with highlights. Scott, what is on the collective mind of DISA these days?
Well, I think what they're doing right now is moving toward mobility and identity insurance. And that's not like that they haven't done this before, but it's a bigger emphasis than they've ever really had on that. And part of that comes in the wake of a $500 million MilCloud contract that they just awarded to CSRA. What they want to do with that is make mobility more prevalent for warfighters. And going into the theater at this point is they're trying to kind of make the world a little more easier for warfighters and make it more connected. So if you think about biometrics, the possibility of biometrics, you know, going in and all these sci-fi kind of movies that we see these days where you can watch your heartbeat and see, you know, what your peers are doing and also see the enemy and information on them, that's something that they might be able to deliver in the near future. But in order to do that, they need to get mobility down.
And this is something the military services have been individually saying, especially the Army, that they want for their members. So it sounds like DISA is trying to keep up with what the demand is from what you might call its customers.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that is also that its identity and mobility are interconnected. They have 56,000 devices that DISA gives out to DoD employees and to military members, and 1,500 classified devices that they're in charge of. They have a lot of products out there that they need to work.
I would say they have to scale those numbers you just mentioned, 1,500 classified, 56,000. They have to scale those by a factor of 10 to have any impact on DoD.
That's right. I mean, you know, DoD has hundreds of thousands of employees. So, you know, this is just the beginning.
I think millions if you count people in uniform.
That's true if you count the people in uniform. They also are trying to get rid of CAT card access too, because right now if you want to get into a classified kind of setting with your phone, you need to put your CAT card in a reader before you can get onto this network, all those kind of things. They're trying to phase that out, make mobility and identity assurance more prevalent. And
are they taking on a task in doing that was originally prescribed, you might say, by the former CIO of Defense Department, Terry Halverson?
That's right. Yeah. And they're staying on track with that. And they're looking to put out, you know, some requests for information in the near future. And, you know, I think that also goes back to that whole biometric thing is, you know, instead of using a CAT card, they want to be able to look at the way that you type and know that it's you, or look at the way that your heart beats, the way that you breathe, your fingerprint. Some of these things we're already seeing. iPhones nowadays can unlock your iPhone using your fingerprint. So, you know, these are all things that are going to eventually come together. Hopefully they're small pieces that will become something like we see in the movies now.
I want to back up just a moment to that $500 million MilCloud 2.0 award that went to CSRA. A new cloud contract, DISA already has a number of them, correct? What is the purpose of this specific contract?
Well, this contract is something that it's completely commercial. It's commercial use of cloud services. And there's not a lot of the details are out yet because they just signed on to this. I tried to get a little information when I was over at the DISA conference, but you know, they're not talking about it because none of the ducks are in a row at this point. So what we know is that this is a commercial application for MilCloud that will go along with the government MilCloud.
We're speaking with Federal News Radio Scott Massioni, and you're also reporting that the Unified Capabilities Request for Proposals coming soon from DISA.
That's right. I think that request for proposal is going to be coming out in late August. But the important thing to remember is that I talked to Mr. Herman, who's the guy in charge of that over at DISA. He said that they're prepared to move to open source if they can't get the right price for the Unified Capabilities. That's especially in the DIOS, which is kind of like a Slack or Skype kind of application.
So they're looking for messaging and peer-to-peer communications and collaboration and telephony in one platform.
That's right. And even video calls, things like that too. So the problem is that they have a lot of customers in DoD and they need them to buy into this. So DISA just gives out the application and then they need the different components or services to buy into this. But that won't work if enough customers don't buy into it. So they need it at the right price from commercial industry to be able to convince these DoD components to buy into it. If you have to pay $500,000 per person, there's no way the DoD components are going to buy in. And of course, the more people that buy into this, the more the cost goes down per person because you're buying it wholesale.
That doesn't sound that complicated. I mean, when you have an individual cell phone or carrier account, you pay per month and you pretty much get unlimited minutes, unlimited text messaging, and whatever data is used by your Slack account, as the case might be, much less if you're in Wi-Fi. So what is it they're looking for that's not there in industry now?
Where this is all coming from is it's coming from the security. And, you know, you go, when I talked to Mr. Herman, Brian Herman, he said, you know, you go and you talk to any marketer out here, he can sell you email for $1 a year. And that's, you know, the quote slick sheet is what, as he called it. But the thing is the Defense Department has a lot of stuff that they need to be secure. And so they're looking at something like $50 a year per person for email, something like that. That's the kind of price that they're looking for. And but, you know, the big thing is cybersecurity. That's what they want. And not all companies need that security that Defense Department has. That's
and if they don't get the price they want, what will they do?
That's where they're going to go to the open source. They'll say we're going to go to something open source and then develop it ourselves from there to have the security that we need. But, you know, that's a big ask and a big build. And it's going to take more time, which means that it'll be a longer time before Defense Department employees see it.
Good opportunity for them to show off their agile chops.
That's right. That's right.
And also, you're reporting some other big contracts that we're seeing from DISA. What's the highlights there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of people are familiar with the Encore 3, the SETI, and we were just talking about unified capabilities. These are all DISA services that are provided to DoD components. And the thing is that these are humongous contracts. Encore is $17.5 billion. SETI is $7.5 billion. And this seems to be a trend that DISA is going toward indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity with multiple awards. That has some industry a little shaken up. They're not really sure how to respond to this. It's a lot of eggs to put in one basket.
And well, it's the indefinite, because if you make a price based on selling a million units, but it's indefinite quantity and you only sell 500,000 units, then your unit cost might go up, but not your unit price, and then you're stuck.
That's right. And how DISA is, I guess, justifying why they're doing this is that they're tired of stovepiping contracts. They're saying that each industry or each company has that one contract that you really like to hug and just kind of keep and make sure it's yours. They don't want to do that anymore. They want to make sure that they can spread out a service, something like email, to just use it in all the different missions that they have, instead of just getting email for one mission, getting an email for another mission, and having 900, 1,000 contracts a year.
Federal News Radio, Scott Massioni, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Be sure to check out his coverage at federalnewsradio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
The Shakespeare Theater Company in the area has a big summer planned. Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News. Now, that gent saith the theater company is moving outside.
The Chesapeake Shakespeare Company moves outdoors from their Baltimore theater down to the ruins of the Patapsco Female Institute in Ellicott City, Maryland, outdoors for the summer. Bring a picnic, see page 8 of the June Recreation News to find out more.
Marvin, I heareth there's a beer festival coming up soon.
The historic St. Mary's City Beer Fest is June 24th, noon to 6 p.m. They have 8 breweries down there and music. Find out more on page 27 of the June Recreation News.
Doth thou has an excitement deal? Okay, Marvin, do you have a fun deal for us this week?
The High Five Adventure at Wisp Resort in Western Maryland is great for families. You get 4 passes to any 5 of the mountain adventures. It's all from $129 per person. See page 10 of the June Recreation News, or as always, recreationnews.com.
Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News.
Soon you may be able to cut the cord from your technology and charge it while on the move. Engineers are creating ways to charge batteries wirelessly, and Shen-Hui Fan, an engineer at Stanford University, is trying to take that a step further, doing it while the device is in motion.
If you have a dynamic charging scenario where the distance of transfer keep changing, then you would need to have basically a tuning circuit running continuously in order to be able to maintain that efficiency.
Fan is working on a system that's able to automatically tune to a frequency that ensures maximum charge.
The circuit is constructed in such a way that you just know what the optimum condition is and lock onto it.
So Fenn says one day you might take that electric car on a trip and keep it charging the whole way. More at www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The FBI's latest internet crime report provides details about the top trending internet scams and associated financial losses. The 2016 report shows the business email compromise scam is the crime with the highest in reported losses, costing victims more than $360 million. The information is collected and analyzed through the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, which receives public complaints of suspected internet-facilitated crime. The IC3 received about 300,000 complaints totaling more than $1.3 billion in losses in 2016. Unit Chief Donna Gregory says a study shows only about 15% of the nation's internet fraud victims report the crimes to law enforcement.
Knowing that that's only 15% of what is reported, those numbers are staggering.
To report internet crime and learn how to protect yourself, visit ic3.gov. I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau with FBI This Week.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Jeff Olson. As Rebecca runs on a treadmill, she's monitoring more than her mileage. She's also tracking her heart rate.
The benefit to working out in your target heart rate zone is to improve your cardiovascular and your respiratory health.
Nicole Burrow is a health and wellness coach. She says exercising at your target heart rate strengthens but doesn't overwork your heart. It also builds lung capacity and improves overall well-being. To find your target heart rate, subtract your age from 220 to reveal your maximum heart rate. Your target heart rate is a percentage of your maximum heart rate.
50 to 70% is more moderate exercise. 70 to 85% is a more vigorous intensity exercise for most people.
Pick your target, then make sure you're hitting it by checking your heart rate during exercise. Burrow says wearable technology may be more accurate than pulse monitors built into machines. And
the most accurate you're going to get is if you take your own pulse, either at your neck or at your wrist.
For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
Profile America, Monday, June 26th. Whoever bought a pack of chewing gum at the Marsh supermarket in Troy, Ohio on this date 43 years ago was making history. It was the first purchase of an item to be scanned into a cash register by using the Universal Product Code, much better known as the barcode. The 10-pack of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit is now on display at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., along with one of the early scanners. The price scanning concept actually dates from the early 1950s, employing a bullseye-type mark, but it proved cost prohibitive. Today, the barcode is part of everyday life for the $4.2 trillion worth of annual transactions in America's nearly 1.1 million retail trade establishments, and the 14.7 million people who work in them. You can find more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
From proving bomb parts can get through front door screenings to examining the Fort Hood shootings, the Government Accountability Office has been following the federal insider threat situation for years. Its work covers both the physical world and cyberspace. I spoke with Joseph Kirschbaum, the GAO's Director of Defense Capabilities and Management, about the range of work he's overseen.
Looked at insider threats based on the Department of Defense's programs that were required by the federal government in 2011. By executive order, required all federal departments and agencies to establish insider threat programs. So we've examined those programs, how they're running, and it's important to note here that we've looked at them in terms of the specific programs and in broad context. And by that I mean there's two real sides to it. There's the traditional physical security side of it. And shorthand for that is guns, guards, and gates. And then there's the information cyber side of it. We looked at, in 2015 in particular, we did two separate reports looking at both of those programs. The physical side of it looked particularly at improvements the Department of Defense was trying to make in response to the Fort Hood shooting, and particularly the Fort Hood shootings in 2009, there was a series of official reviews that recommended very specific actions that the Department of Defense take. We were following up on those as a lens to look at that aspect of the insider threats program. The other side was the looking at information systems, threats to information systems and from insiders. And in that regard, we looked throughout all the department's efforts in terms of their program. And really, we looked at them separately, but they are intricately linked. And we can chat more about that. But in essence, we found in both cases very similar things to what we find when we're looking at these kind of programs. And these kind of programs being security programs, physical security programs. We found that on the one hand, the Department of Defense has clear structures in place. They have doctrine, they have planning, they have training in place that relates to parts of the program, but it kind of doesn't come together as a whole. So we found those kind of gaps and holes in how they approach that. So we made recommendations to improve their programs throughout that area. The definition of insider threats is important because it gets to the scope of the matter. So insider threats are the really looking at the potential for damage to people and information by unwittingly or wittingly, and by people to whom you have by definition given access. So it's important because we're talking about those people who mean to do harm, and perhaps even more importantly, as a percentage of actual incidents, the people who don't necessarily mean to do harm, but nonetheless do cause harm.
I guess that's the largest number of cases, probably 90% are the inadvertence, but most of the damage really is done by the malicious insiders, correct?
It depends on how you tally it up, because you're absolutely right. I mean, you certainly get the cases where we're talking about loss of life. That is absolutely the case in terms of the Fort Hood shootings, the Navy Yard shootings. Those were definitely intentional, and that is absolutely the case. On the other side, you know, the information leaks and things, it becomes a little bit more murky. You have some obviously well-publicized cases where you have intentional leaking of information, but you also have as you mentioned, the vast number of cases where there's actual an insider threat incident tend to be those unwitting cases. And so here we're crossing into the realm of not just potential leaks of information, but we're talking about a lot of mundane things, like people who aren't following the right security procedures and open up a breach that's exploited in some way, shape, or form that could cause damage to networks and such.
Interestingly, that Congress ordered this program that you are part of in 2011, this was before the Edward Snowden affair, indicating that cybersecurity breaches from insiders didn't start with that one, famous and notorious as it's become.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't take a whole lot of vision to appreciate the potential weaknesses of information systems and what the damage might potentially be caused by someone who you've given access to, but you don't necessarily know when that person may decide to do something nefarious. However, it becomes a lot harder when you think about ways to prevent that.
And you mentioned that this concentrates on DOD, so therefore I would imagine it concentrates on the classified networks, that is, on the cyber side of this.
It does. We concentrated largely on the classified side. However, there are direct analogs to how the unsecure networks, unsecure is the wrong term, the non-classified networks, how they would be protected as well. I mean, it's very similar processes.
Because there might be clues to possible nefarious behavior in the classified realm, but those clues might occur in the unclassified realm.
Absolutely. And that actually gets at one of the fundamental kind of underlying elements of how you approach insider threats and the fact that it is at the same time a technical issue, but even more so a human issue. And so how you identify where those potential threats may be, it really doesn't make any difference. You're talking about a classified network, an unclassified network, or you're protecting physical systems. You've got to be able to identify where there are technical vulnerabilities, and also mate those up with an understanding of the human behavior.
We're speaking with Joseph Kirschbaum. He's director of the Defense Capabilities and Management Topics at the Government Accountability Office. And let's talk about how you do that. And also, I would say, in the context of possible physical threats, in the case of the Fort Hood shooting, which all these years later is still painful to even think about, there must have been, I guess we know now that there were clues in cyberspace as to what was going to happen in real time.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that the results from the Fort Hood shooting reports and also the Washington Navy Yard shooting official inquiries, some of the common things that were uncovered were the fact that there were clues, there were bits of information out there that in theory could have been put together. I mean, this is very similar to the story when we talk about things like 9/11 and going all the way back to Pearl Harbor. There were, in theory, clues in place that could have been put together. So the question is, well, how should they have been put together? And should they have been put together? Because in some cases, we're talking about personal information, you know, what's the legal requirement for it to be shared, you know, over and above the should it be shared. And then you also have the element of, even if that information is out there, and if it's collated, how best to share that with the right people at the right time. So a good example of that is one of the things that the results of the Washington Navy Yard shooting uncovered, that a lot of this information was known, but it wasn't shared with the appropriate law enforcement authority at the right time that could have possibly, you know, mitigated attacks like that. And those kind of things, we're back in that realm of what's technically feasible, what's legally required, and then can you and how you do you share.
Probably most well-thinking people are reluctant to rat on someone that they think maybe, well, there's really nothing there, it's none of my business, or they don't want to impugn someone in a way that might be seen as based on racial or ethnic considerations. So maybe that's one of the sensitivities here, is when do people that can maybe be close to the scene and alert authorities to something that might be going on, how do you give them space to do so in a way that is fair to all individuals?
Absolutely, and one of the major considerations and all elements of the insider threats programs is determining where the balance is between personal security, personal liberties, and personal responsibility. Where that line is between all of those, and as you might imagine, that line is not clear. It's not bright, nor should it be. For what we're talking about here, I mean, we're talking about definitely something in the hard to do pile. At its heart, you're trying to determine, you being the agency official, the person responsible for physical and information security, you're trying to determine what is it in your organization that's different from the normal, and to the extent to which it's different from the normal, is it nefarious? Just establishing that baseline of what's quote unquote normal is a horrendously difficult task. Technically,
Joseph Kirschbaum is Director of Defense Capabilities and Management at the Government Accountability Office. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.